You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wood. That will conclude the opening statement of the state. Mr. Pryor, a couple of questions. First, is the defense going to give an opening statement now or defer until later? And second, if you are going to give an opening statement, would you prefer we take a mid-morning recess or go forward?
Judge, could we take a short recess? And I have a statement to speak.
Okay, I think this is a good time then for our mid-morning break. We'll go ahead and take that now. And then once that's concluded, Mr. Pryor can give us a bank statement for the defense.
All rise.
Thank you. Please be seated. Please have the chair, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown.
All rise.
Very present and accounted for.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. We've concluded our morning recess. We're back on the record on KCR 22-21-16-23, State of Idaho versus Chad Daybell. This is the time we'll next have opening statements by the defense. Mr. Pryor, is the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May I have the post permission to enter the well?
You may.
Thank you.
And maybe check that microphone to make sure it is working. Okay?
Very well.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As an introduction, I'm John Pryor. I'm the defense attorney for Mr. Daybell. And I'm from Meridian, Idaho. I'm an attorney from Meridian, Idaho, over here on the west side of the state. I want to talk to you a little bit today. And at my age, video presentations are not something that would come easy to me. So I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about my view of the case and the facts and evidence. And what's important are facts and evidence. I think that when we went through the jury selection process, we talked about facts and we talked about evidence. And the judge gave you an instruction to talk to you a little bit about you take into consideration the facts of this case and not be distracted by other things. Don't be distracted by speculation. Don't be distracted by guesses or assumptions or hunches. It all comes down to facts and evidence. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the facts and evidence in this case. Chad Daybell, and I'm learning this, and I've had some time to learn about this because it didn't come natural to me, but Chad Daybell went on what's called a mission early on in his life. And I guess what a mission is, I'm not familiar with that, but I guess what a mission is they go away to a location and they talk to people about their religious beliefs. And Chad's faith, that was important as part of his faith. And when they return from these missions, they start the process of moving on with their lives. And when Chad got back from doing his mission in New Jersey, he met Tammy Daybell. Another fact that I discovered, and you'll hear a little bit about, is that Chad had an extended engagement, had an extended, by his faith standards, romance before they got married. Chad and Tammy dated for approximately 6 months, and what I understand is by their nature, 6 months is an extended dating process before you end up getting married. So after 6 months, they got married. They were married in Utah and proceeded then to have children. They have five children. Now all five adult children. At some point, they moved back here to Idaho, or moved to Idaho, and they started a small publishing company. And you'll hear testimony that the publishing company was predominantly run by Tammy. Tammy managed it. Tammy was the brains behind the company. And Tammy basically took the reins and did everything that was necessary to move this publishing company. It was a small publishing company. A very small publishing company, and what they did is basically publish books. Chad would write these books, and he would write these books about his religious experiences. In his faith, he had certain beliefs, the faith that he practiced, you know, when he went on his mission, when he, you know, read his interpretation of the books that he used for his faith, he
started writing books about things that were consistent with his faith. Things like premonitions. We've all heard of premonitions, about being able to predict things, about being able to see maybe when things happen. And some people believe in that, some people don't. Some people have personally experienced that, or I've been here before. But he writes about his premonitions. He writes about good and evil, and what it means to be good, and what it means to be evil. He writes about dark and light. He writes about subjects that are a little darker, like death, and maybe the coming of the end of things, and when his Savior in his mind is going to come back, and maybe there'll be some kind of a redemption of some sort. But his books covered a lot of subjects like that, and they were all based on fiction. In other words, he was writing these books about theories and things that came into his head, and he would write these stories. But he also wrote children's books, and he wrote books for teenagers. And he wrote these books about adventures and some crazy ideas about things that kids and teenagers get involved in. In about October of 2018, Chad was going out, and he was invited by one of the witnesses that you'll hear in this case to speak about his books. And this was not uncommon. He would travel, and he would be asked to say, well, come and talk about some of the things that you believe in. You've talked about these premonitions, some life experiences. You're going to hear testimony about that. And he was invited on one particular occasion in late October. And he attended this, and while he was there trying to sell his books, and like most of us who are business people, the focus of these meetings really was for Chad to try to get his books published, because that's how he made a living. And he was there in one of his booths trying to promote his books, and he laid them out there. And this beautifully stunning woman named Lori Vallow comes up, and she starts giving him a lot of attention. And she pursued him, and she encouraged him. And you'll hear testimony that she went so far as to grab behind the booth and sort of help him in trying to sell some of his books. She obviously had an interest, and maybe she felt that he was this publisher, or maybe she had an opinion. You'll hear testimony about that. And then after the seminar, there was a length of time where there was no contact between the two of them, a month and a half, 2 months. And during that time, Chad Daigle went on his day-to-day life. He'd been married to Tammy for some 29 years, has no remarkable background of any kind. I think the testimony was awful. It'll show you. I think he had a speeding ticket in 2005. And Lori Vallow was a different story. Lori Vallow was someone who, right out of high school, married her first husband. You'll hear testimony about this. That marriage was very short-lived. Very short-lived. She then married husband number two a few years later. And again, very short-lived marriage. And there's some testimony indication that there were some problems with the marriage that caused the breakup. But the concern seems to be, the theme seems to be that Lori's brother Alex, and you're going to hear about Alex Cox. Alex Cox was Lori's protector. Alex Cox would do anything and everything to protect, aid, and assist Lori Vallow in whatever her endeavors, without unbridled question, anything. And if Alex Cox even perceived that there was a problem, Alex Cox reacted. You're going to hear testimony that in 2007, I believe it was in August of 2007, Lori Vallow had finished up going through her third marriage with Joseph Ryan. It was a tumultuous, you'll hear testimony that it was a tumultuous marriage, a terrible marriage. And Lori Vallow made accusations against Joseph Ryan of abusing their child, Tylee. Yes, the same Tylee. And during one of the visits of 2007, folks, and I want to tell you, you're going to hear testimony that in 2007, Chad Daigle didn't even know Lori Vallow existed. But Alex Cox, after one of the exchanges and the visitations with Tylee, Alex Cox approached Joseph Ryan and shot him with a taser and assaulted him. Was eventually charged with aggravated assault,
was eventually put in jail and had this on his record. And there was representation, the facts would suggest that at the time Joseph Ryan feared for his life. This was a serious situation. But it set the pattern for what we're dealing with Alex Cox. Whenever there was a problem or a threat to Lori Vallow, you'll hear testimony that Alex Cox came to the rescue. But Alex Cox would run without even question and do whatever was necessary to solve Lori Vallow's problems. We're going to fast forward then to 2019. Lori Vallow is still married to Charles Vallow. And the prosecuting attorney mentioned this, yes. Chad Daigle, at that point, was coming in January and February, started to have communications with Lori Vallow. And yes, folks, it turned into an inappropriate relationship. 2019 and forward. And yes, he was engaging in discussions. He was engaging in contact with her. All of the things that the prosecutor talked about in terms of a relationship. But subsequent to the seriousness of this relationship getting rolling, Alex Cox was at a visitation in 2019 with Charles Vallow. And Lori Vallow was there. Tylee Ryan was there. JJ was there. They were all present. And during that altercation and that supposed visit, much like with Joseph Ryan, Alex Cox took out a gun and shot Charles Vallow. And then after calling 911, he then finished the job and walked up to him at close range, finished him off. Now, you're going to hear testimony that in some way, Chad Daybell is implicated in that. And you're going to hear further testimony that he was not. You're going to hear testimony and see documentation that suggests that the prosecuting attorney on review of this indicated that there is no likelihood of conviction of Chad Daigle. You'll hear testimony that Chad Daigle had nothing to do with the execution by Alex Cox, Charles Vallow. And the same for Brandon Boudreaux. You will hear that Chad Daigle is not being pursued for any involvement in the Brandon Boudreaux attempted murder. Those occurred, and those are separate, as well as the Charles Vallow. So what we have is we have a situation where someone who's 29 years old, Chad Daigle, 29 years of marriage with Tammy Daigle, no discernible issues in his life. And then Lori Vallow comes into the picture, Miss Texas. You'll hear testimony about this beautiful, vivacious woman, very sexual person, and very manipulative. And she knows how to get what she wants. And she drew Chad Daigle into a relationship, and an unfortunate relationship, you know, that Chad fell into. After that, things started rolling, and issues started happening, but eventually, yes, there was a murder, and there was a burial. And you've heard discussion about the backyard of Chad Daigle. Well, we have a 4.5-acre farm in Fremont County, Idaho. And you'll hear testimony that the body of J.J. Vallow was discovered behind an irrigation pond and a tree out in the pasture. So technically, yes, maybe the backyard, but more accurately described as the pasture, hidden behind a tree. You're going to hear testimony that also in the middle of this pasture was a raspberry patch, former raspberry patch, that was then turned into a place for them to bury the cats, the dogs, and all of the animals on the farm. Okay? Again, out in the pasture of the field and not the backyard. You'll hear testimony about that. You're going to hear from four experts that I'm going to bring forward. And these four experts, the first one is going to be Dr. Greg Hampikian. And Dr. Hampikian is a bit of a notable local from Boise State University. And Dr. Hampikian is a DNA expert, considered one of the best DNA experts. He's been involved and has significant work that he's done on both the defense and for the prosecution. He was involved and led the team with Amanda Knox in Italy that got her exonerated because of the DNA evidence. He has substantial experience. And anybody or anyone who knows anything about DNA goes to Dr. Hampinkian first, because he is the guy. And Dr. Hampinkian is going to talk a little bit about the DNA evidence that's found on the scene. Dr. Hampinkian is going to talk about the fingerprint on the plastic that J.J. Vallow was discovered in, was that of Alex Cox. Dr. Hampinkian is going to talk about the hair sample that was found on the plastic of Alex Cox and that it was Lori Vallow. Dr. Hampinkian is going to talk about several, and I mean several other hairs that were found on the plastic of J.J. Vallow. But he's also going to say that there was no DNA evidence, no hair sample of Chad Daybell on Tylee Ryan or on J.J. Vallow. You're then going to hear from Dr. Raven. And Dr. Raven is a forensic pathologist, and she's going to talk a little bit about the circumstances surrounding Tammy Daybell. And what Dr. Raven is going to say is that there's no indication that this is either a homicide or any other crime, and that the only conclusion she can come to is you can't determine what the cause of death was. There's no way to determine it. Tammy Daybell was buried. You'll hear testimony about that. And then a short time later, the police officers showed up and they dug her body up after she'd been buried, after she was laid to rest, and then continued after the body was pulled out of the ground and continued to examine it for whatever they were looking for. And what you're going to find is, based on that, Dr. Raven's going to say you can't determine what the cause of death is. You're going to hear testimony from the Daybell children, from the children themselves, four of the five children, I think, three or four of the five children are going to hear testimony. They're going to talk about their mother's health struggles. They're going to talk about their mother's use of various medicinal treatments that she would use, oils that she would put on her leg, medicine and different herbs that she would take, and that her mother was suffering from, that their mother was suffering from a number of maladies, and that she would refuse to go see a doctor or get it treated. And Dr. Raven's going to enlighten you a little bit about some of the circumstances regarding Tammy Daybell. You're then going to hear from Patrick Eller. He's a forensic digital data examiner. And Patrick Eller is someone who has spent his life in the military working for various agencies, and we'll talk a little bit about that, within the government to do data retrieval and data research. And he's going to talk a little bit about the phone records that are involved in this case. He's going to specifically talk about the travels of Alex Cox, because you are going to hear testimony that Alex Cox went to Chad Daybell's property on the 9th of September. You're going to hear that Alex Cox approached Chad Daybell's property a half a dozen other, five or six other times. You're going to hear testimony that Alex Cox was there on the 23rd. And you're going to hear where Alex Cox was in a number of other times and places and his whereabouts and his travels for about a two and a half month period. And Patrick is going to, you know, offer you some information and data to support all of that. And finally, you're going to hear from a forensic anthropologist, and his name's Eric Bartolink. And Mr. Bartolink is going to talk to you a little bit about the nature and the nature of how the remains of Tylee were burned. Eric Bartolink is going to talk to you a little bit about the lack of complete skeletal remains and why, when Tylee was dug down the ground, there was not a complete set of skeletal remains. In fact, there were a number of pieces of that were missing. You're going to hear a lot of evidence, and the judge has talked to us a little bit about not making a decision until you hear all of the evidence. And there's a specific jury instruction that talks about that. The jury instruction is, you know, consider all the evidence. Listen to the instructions. from the court on how you're to proceed. Listen to the arguments of the prosecuting attorney and the defense, and then and only then do you make your decision. And at the conclusion of all that evidence, and at the conclusion of the judge's instructions, the arguments of both the defense attorneys, I'm going to ask you folks to return the verdict not guilty. Thank you, folks. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
All right, that concludes the opening statement of the defense. Then this time we will commence with presenting evidence. I understand the state does have a first witness to call. Is the state ready and prepared to do that?
Your Honor, the state is prepared. We had spoken with your clerk earlier. We thought we were going to have a brief sidebar.
Okay, let's discuss our schedule and put in a sidebar.
Sure.
Counsel, thanks for discussing scheduling. Our intention here will be to start with the state's first witness that apparently will take some time. So we will plan on taking a lunch hour also at right around noon, if possible. So, Mr. Wood, are you going to be calling the first witness?
Yes, Your Honor. The state will be calling right here, Missy.
All right, well, go ahead and call your witness. We'll have him come up and sworn.
Sir, can you call us safely? When you're facing Madam Clerk, raise your right hand and do some more.
All right. Officer, as you testify, just remember to make an audible response to anything being questioned so that the record stays clear and try to avoid speaking over the top of anyone questioning you. That in mind, then, if you would, if you'd like to inquire in
name. Thank you, Your Honor. Officer, will you state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Ray Hermosillo, H-E-R-M-O-S-I-L-L-O. Is that on?
Your Honor, is that microphone on?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and start over and just talk right into the mic, please.
Detective, will you state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Ray Hermosillo, H-E-R-M-O-S-I-L-L-O.
Thank you. Detective Hermosillo, what is your occupation?
I'm currently a lieutenant in the Detective Division for the Rexburg Police Department.
How long have you been a detective?
5 years.
And how long were you involved in law enforcement before you became a detective?
Before I was a detective, 18 years.
Have you worked for any other law enforcement agency other than the Rexburg Police?
No.
And are you post-certified?
I am.
Detective, have you been involved in the case regarding Chad Daybell?
Yes, I have.
Do you know what Chad Daybell looks like?
I do.
Is he present in this courtroom?
He is. He's at the defendant's table, for sure, in a low screen time.
Thank you. Detective, let's talk about how did you initially become involved in the investigation regarding Mr. Daybell?
On November 1st, 2019, I was contacted by Fremont County Sheriff's Office. I was told that there was possibly a Jeep that was involved in an attempted homicide in our jurisdiction. So at that time, with that information, I contacted Gilbert Police and asked what they needed us to do to assist them.
And what did you do?
Gilbert Police asked us to seize the Jeep if it was located. They gave us the address of 565 Pioneer, which is Rock Creek Townhomes. They also asked us...
I'm going to stop real quick. Where is that address located? What city?
Rexburg.
And what county is Rexburg in?
Madison County.
So once you received that address, what did you do?
Gilbert asked us to seize the Jeep if we had located the Jeep. They also asked us to perform intermittent surveillance. So at that time, that's exactly what we did.
And when you say intermittent surveillance, what did you do to perform that surveillance?
When we were driving around, when there was no other calls coming in, we parked in front of the residence, behind the residence, take photographs of anybody leaving or coming in. That's basically what we did for the surveillance.
And do you recall what dates you did that surveillance?
The dates were between November 1st and November 4th when I located the Jeep at 565 Pioneer.
Did you ever see the defendant at that address?
I did. There were a few times during the intermittent surveillance that we had taken photographs of the defendant, Mr. Daybell, and Lori Vallow, either coming or going from the residence.
And that was between the dates of November 1st and November 4th?
Judge, could we have, for the record, have this officer established the year?
I'm sorry, 2019.
And did you, that, when you talked about seeing Mr. Daybell, was that between those dates of November 1st and November 4th of 2019?
That's
correct. And your primary job was to look for a Jeep. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct.
Your Honor, I'm going to ask that the witness be hand what's been marked, the State's Exhibit 90. Very well. The court has a courtesy copy in counsel as well.
Mr. Wood, to be clear, it sounded like you said 90. This is 98.
I believe it's 98. I double check.
Can I just see the exhibit so I can confirm my voice?
It's okay. Fine. You're correct, Honor. 9A. And that would be exhibits 9A through 90. Detective, do you recognize State's exhibits 9A through 90?
Yes, I do.
What do they purport to be?
That is the Jeep that I had seized parked in the parking lot just outside of 565 Pioneer.
Right. And was this, were these pictures taken at the location of 565 Pioneer?
No, these photographs were taken at our in-town lot at the police department.
Right. Did you take these pictures?
I did not.
But do you recognize these images as true and accurate representations of the Jeep you seized from 565 Pioneer Drive?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd ask the State's Exhibits 9A through D be under the evidence.
Any objection from the defense?
Judge, I'd like to move on to your immediate objection when we see the foundation information.
All right, you can voir dire or ask foundational questions, Mr. Pryor.
Officer Almasino, thank you. You mentioned that you were doing surveillance on the Jeep, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you have an occasion to get close to the Jeep during that surveillance?
We hadn't located the Jeep during that surveillance. I located the Jeep on November 4, 2019, and that's when I had it impounded.
Okay. And at the time of being impounded, did you have the occasion to go through the Jeep and observe the Jeep enter, or were you relying just on the photographs taken in the Jeep? Do you understand my question?
No, sir. Can you repeat
it? I'll rephrase that. Did you have a personal occasion to go through the inside of that Jeep and observe the contents within the Jeep?
Your Honor, I think that goes beyond the scope of this specific exhibit.
I guess the issue, Mr. Wood, is he indicated he did not take these photographs, and some of the exhibits also contain photographs of the interior of the Jeep, so it's proper voir dire and an objection.
Thank you.
May I continue, Judge?
Yes.
Officer, all I'm trying to establish is I don't want you to be able to testify that someone else took the pictures and this is what they found. I want you to be able to, you're authenticating and you're under oath to swear that these are accurate photos. I'm trying to find out if that knowledge is based on your personal experience or is it simply based on the fact that you're relying on somebody else who told you this is what we found. So that's what I'd like you to clarify for me if you would, sir.
Sure. I impounded the Jeep. I was standing next to the officer taking the photographs. And I also went through the Jeep personally.
Okay, I withdraw the objection. Thank you, officer.
All right, exhibits 9A through D are admitted.
Thank you, may I pause to the jury?
You may want to have a quick sidebar with counsel.
Is it like a reporter?
No. All right, Mr. Wood, if you'd like to proceed with publishing the court's instructions there on the sidebar, then you may publish any or all of the photos.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if I could have access to the Detective, is this what you saw in State's Exhibit A?
Yes.
Is this the Jeep that you had been assigned to do surveillance for?
That's right.
Did you ever learn who this Jeep belonged to?
I did.
Who did it belong to?
It was registered to Charles Vallow, but we later determined that Tylee Ryan drove that Jeep.
Detective, this is State's Exhibit 9B. Is this that same Jeep?
Yes.
That's all I'm going to publish now. Your turn.
All right, thank you.
Detective, while you were doing your surveillance, you testified that you had occasion to see the defendant, Maury Vallow. Did you ever see children with her?
No, we didn't.
Did you ever see anybody else with them?
No.
At that time. Were you, at that time, were you aware of who J.J. Vallow was?
No.
Were you aware of who Tylee Ryan was?
No.
So when you spoke with, is it fair to say that when you were initially contacted by another law enforcement agency, they did not ask you to look for those children at that time?
That's correct.
Detective, did your role in this investigation change after that?
It did.
When did that happen?
After I had seized the Jeep November 4th, 2019, I contacted Gilbert Police and let them know I had the Jeep. Gilbert Police Department flew to Rexburg with a few of their detectives and a few of their crime analysts to go through the Jeep and serve a warrant with the Jeep. They were looking for the infotainment center, which is the middle of the Jeep console. It has the GPS locations, things of that nature, and they wanted the information extracted. So when they were up here on November 18th, 2019, they asked me and the other detectives if during our intermittent surveillance if we had seen any children, and we told them we hadn't. They stated that JJ's grandmother.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. I tried to be somewhat open-minded about foundation, but I'm going to object.
I'll ask a question, Your Honor.
Go ahead, thanks.
So you did have further contact with law enforcement from Arizona?
Correct.
And which law enforcement agency was that?
Gilbert Police Department.
And was it Gilbert Police Department that was looking for that Jeep?
Yes, it was.
All right. When you followed up with them about the Jeep, did they give you any other information about their case?
They did.
Did any of that information regard children?
Yes, it did.
What were you told by Gilbert Police?
Judge, objection, hearsay.
It's coming in for the effect on the listener, Your Honor.
Judge, could we approach?
No. Give me a moment to make a ruling on that. On start, the witness can answer the question, but for only the purpose of effect on the listener, if you can clarify that with your witness, Mr. Wood.
Sure.
Any objections overruled?
Detective, based on your conversation with Gilbert Police, did you take any action regarding any children involved in this case?
Yes, we did.
And for the purpose of what you did, what information were you given that you needed to look up on?
We were informed through their investigation that J.J. Vallow's grandmother was concerned for his safety.
Judge, and again, I'm going to object at this point and renew my objection. That's going beyond.
I would also stand that as bringing up your statement, Mr. Wood.
Okay. Based on your conversation with Gilbert Police, what was the next step you took in your investigation?
When we were requested to do a welfare check on J.J. Bello from the Gilbert Police Department.
Detective, had you ever met J.J. Bello?
No.
Were you provided any identifying information as to his age or where he might be?
We were provided very little information, just a brief description of what he looked like, his age, and where he should be, which was 565 Pioneer Road, where he lived with his mother, Lorzell.
Your Honor, I'm going to ask that the witness be handed State's Exhibit 1.
Judge, I'm going to stipulate to the admission of State's Exhibit 1.
All right. It's being offered, Mr. Wood?
Yes, Your Honor.
State's Exhibit 1 has been offered without objection. The court will admit State's Exhibit 1.
And, Your Honor, with that stipulation, I'd actually ask that the witness be handed State's Exhibit 2 and State's Exhibit 3 as well.
Further stipulate to State's Exhibit 2 and stipulate to State's Exhibit 3.
Very well. Then, presuming they're being offered, State's Exhibits 2 and 3 are also admitted. And just to what if they're going to be published in the same issue we discussed before today.
That's all we're doing about. Thank you. Detective, can you look at State's Exhibit 1?
Okay.
What is State's Exhibit 1?
That is a birth certificate out of the state of Louisiana.
Your Honor, where this is admitted, may I publish?
Yeah.
Detective, can you identify who this is a birth certificate for?
The name on the birth certificate is Kanan Todd Trahan.
What is the birth date?
May 25th, 2012.
And where is the place of birth?
Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Your Honor, if I may publish State's Exhibit 2.
Yeah.
Detective, I'm going to ask you to turn to the second page of State's Exhibit 2. Detective, what is State's Exhibit 2?
It's a decree of adoption.
And reading through that, are you aware of who that is a decree of adoption for?
Yes.
Who is it for?
Kanan Todd Trahan.
And on the bottom of that, can you read the second to the bottom paragraph that is a bit?
The entire paragraph?
Yes, please.
It is further ordered, the judge and decree that the name of the child, Kanan Todd Trahan, be changed as follows. Joshua Jackson Ballow and the Registrar of the Louisiana Department of Public Health and Statistics is hereby ordered to make the appropriate changes in its records.
May I publish the State's Exhibit 3, Your Honor?
Yes.
Detective, what is State's Exhibit 3?
That is also a birth certificate from the state of Louisiana.
And who is it a birth certificate for?
Joshua Jackson Bello.
Second, in the course of your investigation, have you learned what Joshua Jackson or J.J. Bello looks like?
Yes.
Have you seen pictures of him?
Yes, I have.
Were you able to access pictures of him from iCloud accounts associated with his mother?
Yes.
Your Honor, I ask that the witness be handed State's Exhibit 4.
All right, the witness is handed State's Exhibit 4.
Detective, you testified that you never met J.J. Bello, correct?
Correct.
How did you come to know what he looked like?
Through photographs you were given.
All right. Where did you get those photographs?
Received a few from Gilbert Police, his grandmother, Kay Woodcock. think that's all I can remember.
And I spoke with you briefly before. Did you ever have occasion to review iCloud accounts belonging to Lori Vallow?
Yes, we did.
And on those iCloud accounts, did you find other pictures of J.J. Vallow?
Yes, we did.
And did you find videos of J.J. Vallow?
Yes.
Based on your investigation, what does Exhibit 4 purport to be?
A photograph of J.J. Vallow.
And you didn't take this picture, correct?
Correct.
But you recognize that individual as Joshua or J.J. Vallow?
Yes.
Your Honor, for demonstrative purposes, the state would move to admit the state's exhibit for
the objection. Judge, there's a little bit of foundation that I would want to iron on. What's the source of that picture? Where did it
Lori's iCloud, Lori for Style, iCloud.com.
Judge, can we approach just briefly on this issue?
Based on our sidebar with counsel, I understand the defense does not have an objection at this point to Exhibit 4 being submitted. Is that correct, Mr. Pryor?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, Exhibit 4 then is submitted.
Your Honor, may I publish to the jury?
Your Honor.
Detective, who is that?
That's J.J. Vallow.
Detective, you were talking about receiving a request to do a welfare check, correct?
That's correct.
When did you receive that request?
On November 25th, 2019, late evening hours, I received a call from Detective Piller with the Gilbert Police Department, and he requested that...
Judge, I'm going to object at this point.
Her request is a hearsay.
At this point, I don't hear an objection on hearsay, so you see.
Go ahead and repeat the question, please.
What did you do in response to that request?
On November 25th, 2019, I received a call from Detective Piller, the Gilbert Police Department. He requested that I do a welfare check on J.J. Vallow the next morning because he wasn't able to get a hold of J.J. or...
That was the same as you're saying.
Did you do a welfare check for J.J. Vallow?
We did.
What date did you do that?
November 26, 2019.
How did you go about doing that?
On that morning of November 26, 2019, myself and Detective Dave Holden went to Lori Vallow's residence where we presumed J.J. was at. She lived at 565 Pioneer, apartment 175. As we approached, expecting to speak with Lori, we noticed the defendant, Chad Daybell, and Alex Cox unloading a pickup truck near the garage area.
And at this point, were you aware of who Chad Daybell was?
Yes.
How would you learn about him?
Through our investigation with Gilbert and communicating with Gilbert Police Department.
And so you recognized who he was?
Correct.
And at that time, were you aware who Alex Cox was?
Yes, we were.
So after you saw them, what did you do next?
I got out of my vehicle and made contact with Alex. He was standing at the driver's side of his pickup truck, and the defendant, Daybell, was on the passenger side. I asked Alex if Lori Vallow was home, and he stated that she wasn't home. I asked Alex if J.J. was home, that we were there to do a welfare check. And at that point, Alex got a surprised, frightened look on his face, looked over at across the pickup at the defendant Daybell. The defendant Daybell then looked back at Alex, and initially, neither one of them answered my question.
After they didn't answer your question, what did you do?
I asked them again if J.J. was home, and Alex Cox finally answered and stated that J.J. was with his grandmother in Louisiana.
When you were given that information, did it cause you any concern?
It did, because I informed Alex that it was highly unlikely because his grandmother...
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. We're going to be getting into your sentence.
I'll sustain that. Your Honor, I think the defendant's about to testify what he said to Alex Cox.
Okay, that's not what I understood where it was going. You can re-ask the question, Mr. Wood.
Detective, what did you say to Alex Cox?
I informed Alex that it was unlikely because Kay...
Judge, I'm going to object. This is going to lead into hearsay.
Your Honor, this is a statement by a declarant on the witness seat. It cannot be hearsay.
Overruled, and it is permissible, so objection overruled.
What did you say to Alex Cox?
I informed Alex that it was unlikely that JJ was with his grandmother Kay because she was the one who called in the welfare check.
And what was the response to that?
There was no response initially. Alex again looked over at the defendant Daybell, and they kind of both just looked at each other. And at that point, I asked Alex where I could find Lori Bell.
And did he give you a location to find her?
He stated that she was in apartment 107, which is the same apartment complex, just a few apartments down.
What did you do at that point?
At that point, I asked Alex if there was a way I could contact Lori and asked Alex for her cell phone number. And Alex told me that he didn't have her cell phone number.
So, were you aware at that point that Alex Cox and Lori Ballo were siblings?
Yes, through our investigation with Gilbert, we knew that Alex Cox and Lori Ballo were extremely close. So when Alex told me he didn't have a sister's cell phone number, I assumed he was lying to me.
What did you do once you received that information?
Myself and Detective Holt left the defendant Daybell and Alex at the pickup truck. We went over to apartment 107 to see if we could make contact with Lori. At that point, we were just trying to find JJ Ballo.
And were you able to locate him at apartment 107?
No, we knocked on apartment 107. There was no answer. So at that point, Detective Hope began knocking on neighbors' doors to see if we could get a hold of anybody who would know if they saw a little boy coming in and out of that apartment or who resided at that apartment. And while Detective Hope was doing that, I started walking back to my vehicle to call for more detectives to come over to our location.
Why did you call for more detectives?
Because of the deception from Alex, I wanted to figure out what exactly was going on. And we were going to start canvassing the area and knocking on doors, so the more detectives we had on scene, the better it was for us.
Detective, to clarify, when you first saw Alex and Chad Daybell, did you speak with Chad Daybell?
No, I personally did not.
So I believe you testified that you started walking back to the original apartment.
Correct.
What happened then?
As I was approaching my car that was parked in the alleyway, I noticed the defendant Daybell driving towards me in a black Chevy Equinox. It appeared he had just left apartment 175 and was headed towards me in the alleyway. So at that point, I stopped him to have a conversation with him.
What did you ask him?
I asked the defendant, Daybell, when's the last time you saw J.J. Ballo? And he stated it was in October in apartment 107 with Lori Ballo.
Did you ask him anything else?
I did. I asked him how he knew Lori, and he stated he had only met her a couple of times and that he didn't know her very well.
Did that response cause any concern for you?
It did.
Why?
through our investigation, prior to me making any contact with the defendant Daybell or Alex Cox, we knew that Alex, Gretchen, Chad, and Lori had been married 2 weeks prior to my conversation with them in the alley.
So, is it fair to say you were troubled by his demolition? What happened after that?
I asked Mr. Daybell, the defendant Daybell, if he had Lori Vallow's telephone number so I could get hold of her. And he stated he didn't have her phone number.
Did you have any further conversation?
I did. When I was speaking with the defendant Daybell, Detective Hope saw me talking with him and started to walk back to my location. As he approached, I again asked the defendant Daybell for Lori's number because I assumed he was lying to me based on what I knew. And at that time, he did give me Lori's phone number.
Did he tell you why he didn't give it to you in the first place?
He did. He stated that he felt I was accusing him of something.
And had you accused him of anything?
No, I simply asked him the whereabouts of JJ and asked him for his wife's telephone number.
Detective, during this interaction, were you wearing a body cam?
No, I wasn't.
Why not?
In the detective division, most of our interviews are in a controlled environment. We call people into the police department. We have an interview room set up with cameras. So most of the time, we're conducting our business and our interviews at the police department. It's very rare we're the first officers or detectives on scene. There's one body cam between seven detectives. Unlike patrol, where a patrolman is assigned a body cam, a detective is not assigned a body
cam. What happened after you got that information from the defendant?
I called my lieutenant at the time and told him what was going on. I felt that based on the deception and lies from the defendant, Daybell, who is JJ's stepfather, the lies and the deception from JJ's uncle, who is Alex Cox, I felt there was more going on with the whereabouts of JJ. And so at that time, I wanted to get everybody over there to see if we could figure out what was going on. So I asked my lieutenant to gather some detectives and respond to my location.
And then what happened?
A few minutes later, my lieutenant arrived with Detective Dave Stubbs, who had a body cam at that point. We began knocking on doors. We went back to 175, which is Lori Vallow's apartment, and started knocking on her door and didn't get any answer.
And I apologize if I missed it. Who was your lieutenant?
Ron Ball.
All right, so after you weren't able to get any answers, what did you do next?
Through our investigation, we learned that Lori Vallow's niece, Melanie Boudreaux, it was Melanie Plowski, no, correction, Melanie Boudreaux at the time, it's now named Melanie Plowski. She lived in apartment 174, which is right next door to Lori. So at that point, we knocked on her apartment as well to see if Lori or JJ was at that apartment.
Did anybody answer?
No, they didn't.
What did you do next?
I was instructed to go back to the police department or the prosecutor's office to see if we can obtain a search warrant to search the residence for JJ Vallow, while the other detective stayed on scene and started knocking on doors in that complex. At that point, our only focus was to find JJ and to figure out what was going on. So we were going to exhaust every means that we could to see if we could do that. And that's why I went to the prosecutor's office to see if I could obtain a search warrant.
And did you obtain a warrant that day?
No.
Why not?
On the way to the prosecutor's office, Detective Hold, with the number that the defendant, Dave Bell, provided, called that number. There was no answer, but he left a message. Once we got to the prosecutor's office, Lori Vallow called back, and she was instructed to open the door. There were detectives outside of her door that wanted to speak with her.
Okay. And are you aware of any other any detectives were able to make contact with her that day?
Yes, they did.
Do you know who that was?
Detective Stubbs and Detective Ball.
And you had mentioned earlier that Detective Stubbs had a body cam on, correct?
Correct.
And do you know if their interaction with Lori Vallow was recorded?
Yes, it was.
Have you watched that video?
Yes, I have.
At that point in your investigation, what did you do?
After
Detective Ball, Detectives Ball and Stubbs had spoken with Lori Vallow, what did you do? What did you do next?
We were informed that JJ was with a family friend.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. How about some foundation?
I will sustain that. Detective, did you speak with Detectives Ball and Stubbs about their interaction with Lori that day?
Yes.
Did you speak with them that day?
Yes.
Did you watch the body cam of their interaction with Lori Vallow that day?
Yes, I did.
So you're aware of what she said to them?
Correct.
Based on what she said to them, what did you do next in your investigation?
We attempted to locate the family friend to see if JJ was with her in Gilbert, Arizona.
And who, do you know who that family friend was?
Melanie Gibb.
Were you able to contact Melanie Gibb?
I was not.
Did you have any interaction with Arizona Law Enforcement Day about contacting Melanie Gibb?
I did. It was starting to get into the later hours of that evening, so I contacted Detective Pillar with Gilbert Police Department. And I had him go to Melanie Gibb's residence to see if JJ was there. Ultimately, we learned he was not there.
About what time did you learn that JJ was not with Melanie Gibb?
Roughly 9 o'clock at night.
And what did you do when you found out that he was not there?
I contacted Lieutenant Wall and let him know, and we agreed to meet at the prosecutor's office that next morning early to obtain search warrants for those apartments.
Okay, and just for clarity of the record, which apartments are you talking about?
Apartment 175, which belonged to Lori Vallow, 174, which belonged to Melanie Boudreaux, and apartment 107. Because that's the last time JJ was seen based on the defendant Daybell's statements.
Detective, were you able to obtain those warrants?
Yes, we were.
What did you do? Well, what day did you obtain those warrants?
November 27th, 2019, in the early morning hours.
And on that day, did you execute those warrants?
We did.
Let's talk about that. Where did you search first?
We searched apartment 175 first.
Was there a reason you searched there first?
That was his address that we were given from Gilbert Police Department, and that's where his mother lived.
What did you find in apartment 175?
So initially, when we broke down the door, everything looked ordinary. There were couches, there were papers on the table, there was food in the refrigerator, food in the pantry. We went upstairs, there were beds, pictures. Everything seemed that people lived there. The thing that caught our attention was There were no clothes on the hanger in any of the closets. Zero clothes. Just a bunch of empty hangers hanging there like somebody took the clothes off and left.
Did you locate JJ in that apartment?
No.
Did you see any evidence whatsoever to suggest that he had been living there?
Yes, we did. There were a couple things. We located a child's Star Wars suitcase underneath a little crawl space under the stairs. It was mixed in with some, what I can best describe as 72-hour kits, and the kits had like flashlights, flares, water. The suitcase was mixed in with those. We also found an old prescription bottle prescribed to JJ of Risperdal. And then we're missing these photographs of JJ in the residence.
And did you see any other evidence of any minor children?
No. Correct. We did. When we first went inside, there were some scooters and a small child's, looked like a small child's bike right on the porch.
Okay. Did you seize anything from the home that day?
We did. I seized the Risperdal and the suitcase.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.